On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. John Tweedle about John Owen, especially as he relates to his work on Hebrews. So we cover all sorts of topics like the ones you'd expect of who is Owen. We especially cover his relationship to Hebrews, how his theology and his exegesis of Hebrews ends up informing his life and his theology, how his commentary on Hebrews comes about and how it compares to others, why he wrote it, what's unique about it, how he understands various theological topics like the Abrahamic Covenant, the Mosaic Covenant, and other areas of research that should be explored as it relates to Owen and Hebrews and much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and I'm joined by Caleb Hawkins, and we are a podcast that's devoted to serious thinking for a serious church. And as we think seriously, we look around the landscape of the church today and we say we need more people who are concerned with thinking properly and thinking virtuously. And so we've tried to encourage an intellectual culture of things like charity and curiosity and critical thinking and cheerful confessionalism. We think that being irenic doesn't mean giving up our beliefs, but it also doesn't mean giving up a spirit of critical thinking. And so we want to like meld all these things together where we want to encourage people to use their minds to the highest level, but to also engage their hearts and to love one another and to desire friendships and opportunities to learn and grow. And so that's what we do with the podcast. We talk to all sorts of people if you're brand new. And we talked about all sorts of ideas, and it's a ton of fun learning and growing and being challenged. And today, I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. John Tweedle. I'm going to be talking about Owen, and particularly in relation to his work on Hebrews. So we've had a couple of episodes on Owen here and there. So I know Crawford Gribben came on and sort of gave a biography of Owen based on his Crossway book that came out a year or two ago, however long it's been. And I think we've had somebody else talk about Owen in relation to something. I don't remember what it is now, but this should be fun. We have I feel like, especially in Baptistic communities, his commentary on Hebrews gets brought up a lot. So I'm very excited to learn more about that. So before we do that, John, tell me a little bit about yourself, maybe what got you interested in Owen, and if you have any favorite stories about Owen that you think people don't know and would love to hear.
Great. Well, thank you, Jordan and Caleb. It's a delight just to be with you all and spend some time thinking together about one of my favorite topics, John Owen and Hebrews. I am a Christian, have known the Lord most of my life, grew up in a Christian family. I am a husband to Angela. We've been married for 20 years. We met at RTS in Jackson. We've got three kids, so I'm a glad dad, and I happen to be a minister of the gospel in the Presbyterian Church in America. And I do all of those things at Reformation Bible College and Ligonier Ministries, where I serve as vice president of academics and as a professor of theology. So at the end of the day, I just seek to be an academic shepherd in caring for students and faculty here at RBC. In terms of Owen, I probably first discovered Owen when I was a college student at William Carey Then College, which is a Southern Baptist college in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. I was attending a PCA church, and my pastor at the time was preaching through Hebrews, and he was quoting this guy, John Owen, a whole lot. And I had never heard anything quite like it, especially on the priesthood of Christ, where he exalted the glory of Christ and then applied it pastorally to God's people, and had just never seen those things come together in quite the same way. Then when I was at RTS in Jackson, I was a research assistant to Derek Thomas, and Dr. Thomas had a great love for Owen and taught a course on the life and theology of Owen. And there I really took time to dig deep into the commentary on Hebrews. And he really encouraged me to think more about Owen and Hebrews, in particular on law and covenant theology surrounding, Owen on Hebrews 8 in particular. So that set me on a trajectory and went to the University of Edinburgh to do PhD work. At the time, I was thinking basically Owen on law and Owen on covenant, But then I quickly realized with all the resurgence of interest in John Owen over the past, say, 50 years or so, very, very little had been done on Hebrews, which was his most important work. So just a little bit of context. Owen was born in 1616. That is the year William Shakespeare died. 2 years before Reformed theologians met the Synod of Dort, and 4 years before pilgrims settled in the New World. So the world he was born into was a tumultuous one. He lived right in the middle period of the 17th century in England, which is one of the most tumultuous and controversial times in England. The kind of waves of the Reformation were crashing on the kingdoms of England and Scotland and Ireland, and Owen kind of grows up right in the middle of all of this. He's widely considered probably the leading kind of English Puritan of the 17th century. He's probably today more widely read than any other of the Puritans. He was a remarkable person. He was an educator at Oxford. He was an advisor to Oliver Cromwell. He was an advocate for toleration. He was a remarkable theologian. And as I've argued, he is a biblical commentator. He dies in 1683, just a few years before the Glorious Revolution, and toleration is being granted to nonconformists. So in many ways, he dies never having won any significant battle in his life. But he did enjoy life. As a young man, he enjoyed throwing the javelin, doing the long jump, playing the flute. He enjoyed brewing his own beer. As a vice chancellor, he wore a very fancy powdered wig. He had famously worn and donned Spanish leather boots. He was a fairly stylish Puritan. C.S. Lewis once described the Puritans as kind of young, fierce, progressive intellectuals. It's not what people typically think of when they think of the Puritans, but in so many ways it captures Owen. So in terms of a favorite story, probably some of my favorite anecdotes with Owen surround his relationship with John Bunyan, who I'm sure will be interested for some of the listeners here today. And there's two famous episodes really that surround Bunyan. Bunyan was in prison. He did not have the connections that Owen had after the restoration of Charles II. And so Bunyan really, in many ways, struggled. But while in prison, he was working on a book that he had long wanted to write, and then is released from prison in 1676. No one will publish this book that Bunyan wrote, and so he talks to his friend Owen. Owen had a publisher, a man by the name of Nathaniel Ponder, who would publish nonconformist literature. So Owen worked it out to take this manuscript to his publisher, and the book never went out of print after that point. And the book was none other than The Pilgrim's Progress. And Owen's publisher became known then as Bunyan's Ponder. And so really Owen was integral in helping Pilgrim's Progress see the light of day. And then the second great kind of anecdote with Bunyan surrounds Charles II, and this is perhaps apocryphal, but it's worth telling. Owen was a white-collar scholar in a lot of ways. He was a man of privilege, a man of connections. Bunyan was not that at all. Bunyan did not have an education. He was a working man, a blue-collar man, a tinker, as he was known. Well, Charles II asked Owen, you know, why is it you would go spend time listening to this tinker? And Owen evidently said, you know, well, sir, if I could possess half the abilities of the tinker's preaching, I would gladly relinquish all of my learning. So it captures something maybe of Owen's connections, Owen's humility, but also his admiration for John Bunyan.
Those are awesome. I did not know about any of that. So that's great. So one of the lines that you have in your work on his work on Hebrews, the volume, you mentioned early on at some point how it's impossible to understand Owen's biography or his theology apart from his work on Hebrews. Mm. Why do you think that is the case?
Yeah, it's great. So as I was getting into the literature, I recognized a lot of people think of Owen as a great theologian, you know, so they'll emphasize communion with God, or they'll think of Owen as somebody encouraging personal piety, and they'll reference mortification of sin. You know, some people maybe in kind of historical circles will pay attention to his advisory role to Oliver Cromwell and focus on Owen as an advocate for toleration. So you've got, you know, Owen the theologian, Owen the pietist, Owen the advocate, Owen the educator at Oxford. But very few people, if any, were referencing Owen as an exegete. And as I was getting into the material, underneath all of his work as a theologian, pastor, advisor, advocate, educator, was his commitment to biblical scholarship. And underneath his commitment to biblical scholarship was a passion, almost an obsession, with the book of Hebrews. So it was something that was largely ignored almost by everyone who had read Owen, with just a couple of exceptions. So I quickly realized that Owen's commentary on Hebrews is more than a commentary on Hebrews. It's really a window on his entire life and ministry, as well as a window on the nature of biblical scholarship in England in the 17th century. So just to put a few points to this, Owen writes this massive commentary. It's published in 4 volumes in his lifetime. Now it's typically published in 7 volumes. So it was published first in 1668, 1674, 1680, and 1684, the year just after his life. In the very first volume in 1668, he explicitly says, "The whole course of my life has been directed toward this one moment, the publication of this commentary. Everything he's done has been for this purpose." And so I took him somewhat at face value. You can't always do that with Owen. He is prone to some exaggeration, but I took his comment, "The whole course of my life has been directed towards this," and tried to unpack that. And I noticed that if you walk through his life, every major season of his life has some relation to Hebrews. So for example, in the 1640s, he begins his pastoral ministry, and he immediately starts writing on the priesthood of Christ. And maybe some listeners are familiar with his book, The Death of Death and the Death of Christ. That comes out of these early pastoral years and his interest in the priesthood of Christ. Well, with that, he starts giving time and attention to the book of Hebrews. Then fast forward to the next decade, in the 1650s, he's now an administrator and professor at Oxford, and he's neck deep in the latest in biblical studies, and he goes on the record for the first time saying, "I want to give my life to writing the book of Hebrews." And then when he's kicked out of Oxford at the restoration of Charles II, completely deflated and defeated in 1660s till the rest of his life in 1683, he devotes explicitly his energies to the book of Hebrews. So literally in all phases of his ministry, he's thinking about and writing on Hebrews, and yet very few people were interacting with Hebrews. I think part of that is because in the publication history, both in the 18th and 19th centuries, and even the 20th centuries, Owen's writings were often published without the commentary. So people would get his theology or his devotional writings, but they really paid little attention to his commentary, primarily because it's so massive and people simply didn't have the time to go through it. So for a lot of reasons, I thought it'd been neglected and it was time to reprise Owen, not simply as a theologian, but also as an exegete. And that's where the project came out of. Yeah, Caleb.
So you've talked about how it hasn't received a lot of attention in later times. Yeah. In his own day, was it something unique in terms of, were other people writing commentaries in this way, this size, and in his own day, were people reading it alongside his other major works, or was it neglected in his own day as well?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. All right. So no, there's nothing quite like it. It's a remarkable commentary on a lot of levels. If you think about this, in Greek, the Epistle to the Hebrews is about, I think, 5,000 words or so, maybe 4,000 and something. The King James Bible, I think, has over 700,000 words in it. Owen's commentary comes in at about 2 million words. It's more than twice the size of the Bible. It's a fourth of his entire corpus. It is just insanely massive. There's something not quite right about that, in all honesty, but Owen had a lot going on in that commentary. And as I kind of hinted at a moment ago, there's more going on than just a commentary. But when he wrote this, he basically thought that there was a gap in scholarship. There were about five or six English-based commentaries at that time. Some of them were polemical, some of them were theological, some of them were homiletical, some of them were heretical. But none of them were comprehensive, and none of them could compare with similar commentaries that were being produced in the wake of the Reformation in Europe. So you have Johannes Oecolampadius in Germany writes a commentary on Hebrews in the 16th century. Then in the Netherlands in the 17th century, you have Johannes Coxeus, who writes a massively learned commentary on Hebrews. There's nothing like that to compete in England. Owen, yes, is a scholastic, but he really is an English theologian and is wanting England to lead the way in the Reformation. And to do that, it needs its own commentary. So he wants a commentary that can serve scholars. And so he has technical commentary where he gets into what we might call today biblical criticism. Then he wants his commentary to serve pastors. And so he has an expository section, which is the largest chunk of the material. And then he also wants it to have some devotional value. And so he has kind of homiletical observations at the end. So the book could actually appeal to scholars, students, pastors, and lay people. And there was something in it for everyone, which I'm not sure was a great tactic, but at least that was his intent. In terms of readership, it took time because it was so expensive. People could not afford the commentary. But you do find towards the end of his life, people begin to pay attention to it, both in England and on the continent. And there's some intention to translate it in Latin as well as in Dutch, as it's appealing to a wider kind of reformed readership. So yes, by the end of the 17th century, it really is the piece of literature that is kind of justifying Owen's standing as a premier biblical scholar in England in the 17th century.
So I'm familiar with sort of a little bit of the story of how Owen became more popular today, given the work of Banner of Truth and the republication of a lot of his works. In his own day, is it the commentary on Hebrews that's making him well known? Is it something else that you would say that this is really like establishing him as a theologian that people are paying attention to?
Yeah, so I would say it's a couple of things. One, I mean, early on, his preaching before Parliament puts him on the radar. I mean, he's the guy that preaches before Parliament the day after Charles I is beheaded, which is just insane. He's a 20-year-old, you know, he's in his 20s. He's a rising star, and he's the guy that goes before Parliament. I mean, it's just quite remarkable. He was a man who could move and shake, and he was probably fairly opportunistic in the way he took advantage of things. So he knew how to place himself that would advantage his cause. Early on, Death of Death puts him in the crosshairs of Richard Baxter, and that begins a lifelong kind of contentious relationship between the two, and there was a little love lost between the two of them. But Death of Death certainly put him on the radar when he was at Oxford. Communion with God did have some controversy, and people loved it. But then later in his life, I do think it's probably his stuff on the Holy Spirit and on Hebrews that endears him to kind of the nonconformist community, as well as perhaps some of his writing on toleration. But then once you get into nonconformist literature, it really is a lot of his devotional material. So stuff on heavenly mindedness, on Psalm 130, which is an exposition on forgiveness and assurance. So a lot of his devotional material gets picked up by kind of the various nonconformist traditions. But there is a steady trickle of people that try to retain Owen's commentary on Hebrews, not least of which are actually Baptists.
Yeah. Mentioning the Baptist piece, it's interesting. I remember even in my MDiv, I was doing a Greek exegesis course on Hebrews. Hmm. I think one of the only older commentaries that people regularly were referenced in class would be John Owen's.
All right.
Regularly bringing out his commentary on it to kind of spar with it, to understand what's going on there. And I'm curious. I mean,
One other thing on that. The other two groups that would picked up on Owen on Hebrews in North America, at least, were the Mathers in New England and in the Puritan communities surrounding Massachusetts and even Harvard, where there was great interest in Owen's commentary on Hebrews. And then next to that in the 18th century would have been Jonathan Edwards. Edwards picks up Owen on Hebrews in several places. And actually there's record of Edwards distributing his own set of his commentary on Hebrews to some of his parishioners and colleagues. So the Mathers and Edwards have a particular place in encouraging Owen on Hebrews in North American Christianity.
Did you know that Gateway Seminary offers PhD and THM degrees with accomplished faculty members, and that their PhD program operates on a hybrid model, which is going to combine the best of the American and British systems to ensure students receive a breadth of knowledge through the seminar stage and close one-on-one mentoring during the dissertation writing stage? Gateway is unique in their delivery format, which is going to provide community support and flexible access. Wherever you're located, you have the opportunity to study with the best. If this has piqued your interest, you should go learn more at info.gsdegrees.org/PhD. That's info.gsdegrees.org/PhD. So when it comes to his work on Hebrews, there's two things that I'm probably most interested in, and it's the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant, and how he understands those things, particularly in relation to his exegesis there. I'm going to start with the Mosaic covenant just because I think it's interesting, because it seems like there's a lot of people that contemporary who want to like appropriate him as a Owen's sort of like a proto-Baptist in some ways, anticipating some of their thoughts, but also just given the, I don't know all the nuances of if it was the OPC study committee or whoever did that on the nature of the Mosaic covenant and whether it's covenant of works or covenant of grace and these different things. I think it's fascinating. So I'd love to understand what is Owen's position? How does it relate to like contemporary Reformed theology when it comes to the nature of the Mosaic covenant?
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
And Dr. Tweedill, maybe a question to help place it is what Owen says about the Mosaic covenant novel in his own time. Mm-hmm. How would it have been thought of in terms of his placing of it in the 17th century?
That's great. Yeah, thank you. On that question, Mark Jones, PCA minister, has helpfully called Owen's contribution on the Mosaic covenant a minority report. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. He self-consciously distances himself from his Reformed colleagues as understood in Westminster Chapter 7, Westminster Confession of Faith Chapter 7, that articulates a view of covenant theology where you have the one covenant of grace and multiple administrations. So seeing the Mosaic covenant as simply a administration of the one covenant of grace. Owen flat out rejects that view, even though in substance, I'm not entirely sure he's all that far off from Westminster, but there are some semantic differences that he has that he wants to file a minority report. So just try to zoom back. A lot of people, when they get into Owen, they focus almost exclusively on his exposition on Hebrews chapter 8, verse 6, where he has an excursus on the new covenant. It's important to pull back and pay attention to what Owen is doing broadly in his commentary. And it's important to understand a couple of things about it. Part of the reason for the length of the commentary is that Owen writes a series of introductory essays called Exercitations that are really serve as a prolegomena or introduction to the commentary. And it allows him to address kind of Bible background issues, such as authorship and original audience, but also what we might call today biblical theological issues. And so in these essays, he does outline a theology of the Abrahamic covenant, which Jordan mentioned a moment ago, and he also outlines an overview of the Mosaic covenant. So he kind of paints with a fairly broad brush his understanding of the Mosaic code in relationship to what we would call today redemptive history. And then once he gets into the commentary, he looks at the exegesis. And so you've got to kind of think about Owen developing hermeneutical principles in the essays and Owen teasing out exegesis in the commentary, and they actually do go together here. So let me try to unpack this. Regarding the various views of the Mosaic Covenant, the place of the Mosaic Covenant within the landscape of federal theology has simply long puzzled Reformed theologians, and there's very, very little consensus, as seen, for example, in the OPC's study report on the Mosaic Covenant. Owen himself actually acknowledges, he says it's a subject wrapped in obscurity. Now, if Owen can't see the light, I suspect we can't either on this as well. And Owen is at best convoluted, and it's a convoluted debate, and he's not always entirely clear about it himself. So here's the point. Some people see the Mosaic Covenant as a recapitulation purely of the covenant of works. Owen doesn't believe that. Some people say it's an administration of the covenant of grace. Owen doesn't believe that. Some people think it's a mixture of both, and Owen doesn't believe that. He's unhappy with all of these paradigms. And in some ways, Owen defies the paradigm, and he's driven by his reading of the text. And in this sense, he anticipates a biblicist instinct. Owen himself will say, I want to go nakedly to the text, and I want to pay attention to the text. And so he's trying as hard as he can to tether his conclusions to what he sees in Hebrews chapter 8. So what he argues is that both the old covenant in Moses and the new covenant in Christ are technically distinct from the covenant of works and grace. Part of the problem is that we equivocate our use of terms. So he's not using covenant the same way when he refers to old covenant and new covenant and covenant of works and covenant of grace. He actually sees those as something different. For Owen, the covenant of grace is a theological construct that provides the promise of redemption. And because the covenant of grace is essentially promissory, he's trying to preserve the integrity of promise when he speaks about the covenant of grace. So in his mind, the old covenant in Moses and the new covenant in Christ provide what he calls the testamentary foundation to the covenant of grace. So they're subservient to the covenant of grace. That argument, the subservient nature of the Mosaic Covenant, comes in some form in the theology of John Cameron and the school of Emeraldianism, which is really, really interesting. Now, Owen does not explicitly state that, even though at times in his writings, he clearly refers to the Emeraldians and people like John Cameron, but it's conjecture there. if he explicitly draws from anybody, he actually draws from unnamed Lutheran sources. And in this context, he likes the fact that Lutherans operate with a law-gospel distinction, where the Mosaic Code provides, in his mind, the legal foundation of the covenant of grace. So the old covenant is the law, and the new covenant is the gospel, or as he likes to talk about it, you have promise and fulfillment here. So in short, Owen believes that conflating the old and new covenants with the covenant of grace dilutes the promissory nature of the covenant of grace and fails to understand what he calls the testamentary nature of the old and new covenants. So he criticizes his Reformed colleagues for failing to understand this testamentary nature of the old and new covenants. He is eclectic in his use of scholarship, drawing from Emeraldian and Lutheran sources in order to provide a fairly nuanced and quirky exegesis of Hebrews 8, in order to say that in many ways, neither the old and new covenant in scare quotes is technically a pure covenant in the same way that the covenant of grace is. So that's long and convoluted. It's the best I can possibly do. I've been thinking about this issue now for about 20 years, and I'm still not entirely sure I got Owen right on it, but that's my best shot.
Do you think there, for those who are interested, is there somebody better than Owen on the Mosaic covenant that you'd say, go here to have a clearer understanding that's probably more consistent?
Right. Westminster chapter 7. I'm just not convinced that Owen got this right. Even though, here's the thing, even though I can honestly appreciate, he's trying to wrestle with diatheke here, diatheke, and how diatheke underscores the nature of a testament. And the benefits of the covenant of grace are secure by the death of Jesus Christ in fulfillment of what the Mosaic Code taught. Yes and amen, and I think he gets that right. But as he starts to schematize this, I just think he had a bad day, in all honesty. So I like my friend Stephen Myers, who is a professor at Puritan Seminary, has written a great introduction to covenant theology called God to Us. And he does a great job working through the Mosaic Covenant, as does Richard Belcher, who is a professor at RTS in Charlotte, has an outstanding textbook on covenant theology that's published with Christian Focus. And I would encourage listeners to check out both Stephen Myers and Richard Belcher's recent books on covenant theology.
That's awesome. I wanted to follow up on one comment you made in describing the Mosaic Covenant, and it's not related to the Mosaic Covenant, but to Owen's sort of impulse, I think you described it almost as biblicistic in some ways. And today, biblicism seems to like be like one of those like really popular words that you throw to your enemy. That if you want to tar and feather them, you're going to call them a biblicist, and that kind of wins the day. So, in what sense is he a bad sort of biblicist, as we would think of it, where we want to like get rid of tradition and we just want to really truly come to the text and not have any presuppositions at all, or is it just more of a principled, I want to prioritize the text of Scripture? And so when that terminology is used, it doesn't really map on to how people today might be using that phrase.
Right. Yeah, I think it's the latter, not the former. But he does use statements that are startling. I mean, like going naked to the text. There's a wonderful book that he wrote in his project on the Holy Spirit where he maps out his hermeneutical approach. It's called The Causes, Ways, and Means of Understanding the Mind of God, one of my absolute favorite books that John Owen wrote. And there he outlines three means of biblical interpretation. The first is a spiritual means. So here he's clearly an early modern or a pre-modern here, where the text of Scripture is a spiritual text. And so we deploy spiritual means. We rely on the Spirit of God who inspired the text to illumine our minds and hearts to understand the text. So you've got to exegete through prayer and communion with God. The second means is what he called disciplinary means. This is the hard work of exegesis. This is studying ancient Near East. This is studying Greco-Roman. This is knowing your Hebrew, your Aramaic, your Greek. This is working through grammatical, historical issues, textual issues, those disciplinary issues of exegesis, the hard work. That's the secondary means. The tertiary means is what he calls the ecclesiastical means, and that's church tradition. And he holds it fairly loosely, in all honesty. He is a Protestant scholastic broadly, but he's not entirely happy with aspects of the tradition of scholasticism. He will push back on some of the loci method of doing theology, even though that's more rhetorical than substantive. So he'll write a book where it's called Theologumena, which is a prolegomena to theology. But rather than deploying the classic loci method, there are a few theologians at that time beginning to think about how the development of the Bible informs the progress of theology. We don't have a discipline of biblical theology yet, but Owen is one of the first to begin to really probe that issue, because his instinct is to focus on the text. And that instinct anticipates kind of the evangelical instinct. I don't think it's biblicism in the sense that there's no concern for history, no concern for dogmatics, but it is biblicist in the sense that he begins with the text and he goes wherever the text leads, even if it puts him out of step with his Reformed colleagues.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Caleb.
So if somebody wants to really dig into his covenant theology on even some of these controversial issues like the Mosaic Covenant, a lot of focus is obviously on the Hebrews commentary, and particularly Hebrews 8. Is there other places in his corpus, which is so large, if you really want a full picture of what he thinks about covenant theology, to go to? I know there's a reprint of some work that's in their entitling Biblical Theology that's out there right now. What are some areas you really want to be well-rounded on Owen's theology to go to?
That's right. So the text, Biblical Theology, is a loose translation of this book, Theologumena, that I mentioned a moment ago, which were based on lectures in Oxford. It's a good place to go to get a sense of his covenant theology in its broad sweep. However, it's not purely a textbook on covenant theology. And the text, Biblical Theology, is a bit like a combination of an NIV or Message translation of Owen's Latin. So if you know a little bit of Latin, it might help you to supplement the reading of Biblical Theology. Unfortunately, he did some prefaces to a couple of works on covenant theology, one written by Patrick Gillespie on the covenant of redemption, and another by Samuel Peddo on the covenant of grace and the Mosaic covenant, actually, as well. And those are maybe his most concise statements of covenant theology. Then there are some places in his work on justification by faith alone where he outlines in very concise fashion his covenant theology. Otherwise, you are left with, I think, going through his commentary on Hebrews, unfortunately. So there's no one place where he puts it all together. Hmm.
So as far as his ideas on the Abrahamic covenant go, how does he understand that? Is that consistent with more traditional Reformed theology, where his Reformed colleagues would say, yep, we're on the same page on these things?
Yeah, I can't find anything that's unique to Owen's view on the Abrahamic covenant. He really sees that as the foundation of all of redemptive history. So people under the Mosaic era would in many ways be redeemed through the promise as it was given to Abraham. The unique place of Abraham is that he exhibits both spiritual and carnal privileges to the people of God. The spiritual privilege given to Abraham is seen in the priority of faith. So, Abraham believes and it was credited to him as righteousness. So whether you're Jew or Gentile, the priority is on having the faith of Abraham. And yet that's not to discount the presence of the physical nature of the promise. So Owen teases that out in the sense that the promise of God given to Abraham cast that promise in a fleshly mold, so that the Messiah comes from the loins of Abraham and God blesses the children of Abraham in Israel. The mistake that Israel makes is it presumes upon that heritage, and they prioritize the carnal privileges over the fleshly privileges. So they think their status as an Israelite can brook favor with God, and it downplays the importance of having faith in the Messiah. He has a very wonderfully concise essay, rare for Owen to have a concise essay. It's titled The Oneness of the Church. And so the oneness of the people of God throughout all redemptive history is predicated on the oneness of the promise of God in the Messiah, redeeming his people in all times and places. So because there's one Messiah and one message of salvation, there is one people of God on both sides of the testament there. So you don't have Israel and the church. You have the people of God who are formed on the basis of their faith in the Messiah. And so Owen is pretty over the plate on that, but he's really, really clear and helpful. And I think that essay on the oneness of the church or the oneness of the people of God is one of the most overlooked but important in his whole project. Yeah, Caleb.
So you talked about an overlooked piece of scholarship in Owen. What right now really excites you about Owen's scholarship? And what are the big areas you think really are dying to be done for aspiring PhD students, those who would like to write on Owen? Where do you think the energy should go?
Great. Well, my colleague Crawford Gribben and I, as well as Marty Cowan at Union Theological College in Belfast, we are hosting the first International John Owen Convention in Belfast this summer. And if anybody is listening and wants to come, you will find information about that conference at the Union Theological College in website in Belfast, Northern Ireland. So we would love for people to come to it. We're going to have seasoned scholars. We're going to have PhD students, and we're going to have people that are in ministry and just who love John Owen together, thinking critically about new areas of research in John Owen. There's several things, you know, in my own world, I would love to see more done on what might be called kind of Owen's kind of critical biblical scholarship, his use of critical biblical studies. Owen is a man who is in between orthodoxy and modernity. He anticipates so much of modern biblical scholarship, but retains some old assumptions of the text as well. I think more can be done on that issue, surprisingly enough. So I would like to see that done. I actually think there's a lot more in the commentary on Hebrews itself. I'm actually going to be looking at a dissertation from New Zealand, looking at the reception history of Hebrews 6 and Owen's influence on the reception history there, which is extraordinary. There's some good work done on Owen's politics and his stuff on nonconformist political theory that I think could be really, really helpful. If anybody has looked at the handbook that Crawford Gribben and I put together, there's a chapter by Katie Galloway at Baylor who looks at Owen's interaction with the scientific revolution. Nobody has touched that at all. And so how Owen is engaging with developments in modernity, I think that's something that could be teased out as well. So there's lots still there, but I would say kind of Owen in biblical scholarship, Owen in the kind of scientific revolution, Owen in politics, those are areas that I still think there's a lot there to do. And then maybe his reception. You know, how Owen has shaped global Christianity, not just in North America, but in places like Korea and places like Brazil. I mean, there are pockets of Owen readership that I think would be really interesting to find out. Places like the Netherlands, there's been a little bit of work done on that. But I think Owen reception is also an interesting topic.
You know, you mentioned Marty as well as Crawford, and I start thinking about like all the great people who are working on Owen. And part of the excitement, I don't remember who it was. I think Richard Cross made a comment one time in an interview about how a particular figure ended up getting a lot of publicity in part just because of the people who were studying them. And I think of you and Crawford and Marty and others. And I'm like, these are just really good people who care about theology and care about the church. I'm like, that's to me part of the reason you'd want to study Owen. But I wonder about the people who, when they see somebody who's popular, they say, I don't want to devote my energies to this person. So, for example, I think of somebody like Jonathan Edwards, who seems to have waned a little bit in his popularity over the last decade or so. There was a time when everybody wanted to have the Jonathan Edwards is my homeboy t-shirt or whatever. So is there a sense in which you would say you should still devote your energies to Owen? Don't let it, because a lot of people think, a lot of people like him, don't let that turn you off. You should devote your energies still to Owen because there's still value here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it's a question of what a person's purpose is, if they're wanting to do academic research or if they're just wanting to grow in grace and grow as a more effective minister. That really, at the end of the day, was my first motivation. I am first and foremost a minister of the gospel, and I wanted to learn from one of the great pastors in church history. And so I devoted my doctoral research to studying from somebody like John Owen. I thought it was a good way to do doctoral work that would prepare me for gospel ministry. I wanted to dig deep wells in order to offer cups of cold water to give God's people. So that was a real impetus for me. And if your desire is just to learn from one of the great teachers of the church, then there's always incentive to read John Owen. But if you're just trying to figure out who to study in order to write a doctoral thesis, I still think there's more to learn from Owen, but you may want to take a tactic where you find somebody that nobody has written on. That way, the secondary literature review will be much shorter than if you're going to read on Edwards or Calvin or Owen. But I think it's important for good people to give their time and attention to the best minds that God has given the church. And for that reason, I hope people will always study John Owen.
Yeah, I think that one of the difficulties to start reading Owen is just the how big his corpus is, right? So I heard a professor one time kind of spread a rumor that it was true or not true, I don't know, that John Webster, the English theologian, had read the whole corpus of John Owen. And another professor of mine said he refused to believe it. That cannot be true just with how massive the corpus is. So we have a lot of pastor theologians, pastors who read widely, who are listening to this program. If they're coming to Owen and say, oh, where do I start? Where can I get the most bang for my buck in starting on this journey of really drinking deeply from the life and theology of John Owen? What's kind of a roadmap you would give them to start?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I work with college students, and I work with a lot of people that are interested in gospel ministry. They aspire to become servants in Christ Church. And I tell them, you know, if you want to begin well, look at those who have ended well and follow in their footsteps. I think that's true of John Owen, too. If you want to start with Owen, look at what he did at the end of his life and start there. My favorite book, actually, that Owen did is actually not Hebrews. It's his last book, Meditations and Discourses on the Glory of Christ. Now, Owen's exposition on the priesthood of Christ is why I love Hebrews so much, his commentary on Hebrews. Owen said that Hebrews is as important to the church as the sun is to the earth. Right. So in the book of Hebrews, we are able to enjoy the effulgent splendor of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That's why I'm just so captivated by Owen's exposition on Hebrews. It's actually not the commentary on Hebrews 8 and the Mosaic Covenant. That's interesting. But it's his stuff on Hebrews 2 and Hebrews 4, on the priesthood of Christ, on Hebrews 7, Hebrews 10. That's far more rewarding and interesting. So I would encourage people to go into the commentary on the priesthood of Christ. But if you just want a consolidation of all of it, read his last book, Meditations and Discourses on the Glory of Christ. He says this: beholding Christ by faith on earth is preparation for beholding Christ by sight in glory. So how does our existence here on earth prepare us for beholding the glory of God in the face of Jesus for all eternity? It was written after a time when Owen lost all of his children, his wife, his job. I mean, it was a torturous time in his own life. And the one thing that sustained him was his vision of the glory of Christ. And so I would highly recommend people start there. He also, in the early part of his ministry, wrote some catechisms on the person and work of Christ. And then I would go there next. So see how a mature Owen thought about Christ, and then see how a young Owen thought about Christ and taught in a catechetical way about the person and work of Christ to people in his congregation. So you can get his two catechisms on the person and work of Christ. That's where I would go.
Awesome. Well, that's an appropriate note to end on. John, this has been really great. Remind me, you're at Reformation Bible College, is that right?
Reformation Bible College, right here in Central Florida.
And the primary students who are attending there are who?
So we got undergraduate students, predominantly 18, 22-year-olds, who are interested in studying theology at an undergraduate level.
Excellent. And you're right next to Disney World for whatever that's worth, and the ocean. So you've got, I guess, some cool things around you.
Yes.
Thanks, John. This has been great. I encourage everybody who's been listening. I mean, go check out his work, but check out some of the other resources that we've mentioned. I'll make sure to link to the books like by Stephen Meyer and Richard Belcher that were mentioned as well. So you can go take a look at those, get copies of them, and edify yourself and your church. So John, we appreciate the work and labors you're doing here. Check out the John Owen Conference at Union Theological College, and keep doing the work you're doing, John. We appreciate it. And everybody tuning in, thanks for listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon. Do you like your coffee black, the way God intended it, so you could treasure the notes of each flavor? Yeah, that means none of that Jake Stone milk with a dab of coffee stuff. Well, if you do, our friends over at Virtue Coffee Company are offering 10% off your whole order if you use code LYCEUM2024, making an already affordable cup even more so. So if that's you, go on and check out their offerings over at virtuecoffeeco.com. There's a link in the show notes that'll take you directly there. And use code LYCEUM2024 and support a Christian coffee company.